You're listening to Walk-Ins Welcome with me, Bridget Fettesy, on Podcast One, where everyone is welcome. This is Walk-Ins Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you are welcome. You know the drill. Please subscribe, rate, comment, share, reach out, tell your friends, send smoke signals, whatever. We love your feedback and we want to hear from you. Our guest this week is author of memoir Chaos Monkeys, formerly at Facebook and notoriously and briefly at Apple, and currently writing at thepullrequest.com, Antonio Garcia Martinez. Antonio is a brilliant mind. I love his perspective on all things tech. This podcast can get a little bit meta because this happens to be his wheelhouse, talking about media, thinking about media and tech in general. It's fascinating. I could talk about this stuff all day. I'm with Antonio Garcia Martinez, everyone. Welcome.
Thank you, Bridget. Thank you for having me.
I feel it's overdue.
I know. We've met before. We've chatted in the same house. Somehow a podcast didn't happen. And yeah.
I don't even know if I had a podcast at that point, or it might have just been
you just started it.
No. Yeah. I still was just a newbie in the podcast space, although I still feel like a newbie in the podcast space. So I was going to ask just a random question because I love starting things off with random questions.
Okay.
And I'll tell my story first.
Okay.
What is something you've done lately that you've felt ashamed about?
Ashamed about?
Mine is really shallow, but I ended up talking to my therapist about it for like an hour today.
I mean, other than getting fired by Apple and becoming the tech media story for a week or more.
Yeah, you were the internet, what do they call it? Like the person of the week or whatever?
Yeah. The title you don't want.
Were you ashamed of that though?
No, actually, no.
Yeah, I don't think that's anything that you should be ashamed of. That feels like something that happened to you, not necessarily that you did.
Fitting justice or just randomness in the universe, who's to say?
Yeah, I guess it depends on where you're coming from. Some people would feel like it's karma or something.
Yeah.
I still don't really fully understand what happened. Can you explain to the people listening? Are you allowed to?
No.
Okay, so they can Google it.
Yeah, what's in the public record is obviously in the public record.
Right.
And so, that's pretty easy to find.
Okay. No. So Google it, guys. Sorry. You have computers. Something happened, and now, what, are you on a sabbatical?
Yes, this is like the post-cancellation purgatory, I guess. It's limbo.
So do you consider what happened to you to be getting canceled?
You know, I asked myself the question, in theory, presumably, I mean, certainly from large public company employment.
Right.
Probably, but more generally, no.
Right.
I think, I mean, my read on it, obviously it's somewhat biased, is that the media story was somewhat in my favor, if not mostly in my favor. And so, I had thousands of misses from well-known people to just, random people who were supportive.
Right.
I literally couldn't get through it all. So I know some of you I didn't get back to you. I'm sorry, but it was just too much. It was weird. When it was going down, just my personal experience, and not talking about the corporate side at all, there was this, I don't understand why, but there was this weird, I mean, if I was more religious than I am, although we can get into that, or if I was more Christian than I am, I would say that there was some feeling of grace, right? Feeling touched by some sort of serenity, tranquility about it. That normally I'm a hot mess, and I would literally have been the most anxious wreck and taken it out in various dysfunctional ways. That absolutely did not happen at all.
Interesting.
And it was just this bizarre feeling of calm while the world exploded. And I really cannot explain it.
Huh. That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of what this podcast is about, is overcoming, resilience, grit, overcoming hardship, and how you respond to hardship. And it's interesting that would happen to you when, as you kind of mentioned, your world exploded. Because you had moved.
Yeah, right? I mean, there's that's in the public record. Yes. I you know, I was based in the Northwest on this little island in the Northwest for
a
while.
It looked gorgeous.
It's still a gorgeous place, Orcas Island. I had built sort of a compound there. I planned on spending years here. Having my kids have been there and stuff, and then I sold it. I mean, it literally the transaction closed the day that this all went down, and so I was moving from most of my life from the Northwest to back to the Bay Area when it happened. And so it was just bizarre juggling this massive PR situation with, like, I literally had my Jeep full of stuff parked on the street in Seattle for like 2 weeks. And I didn't know what to do. It was like, do I ship it down? I can't spend 2 days driving it. I won't bore your listeners with like the planes, trains, and automobiles that was involved. But I had to fly up there a couple times. I had to pay people to ship stuff. It was just a disaster.
Wow.
Because you know, you're moving your entire life, and then you hit, like, eject in the middle of it.
Right, right.
And it was a very strange situation to go through. But, you know, I think I've landed in a nice place. You know, it's, again, that feeling of grace or tranquility about it has never really left. I didn't have, like, a panic attack 2 weeks later when I realized what happened.
Yeah.
So far, so good. I mean, it, you know, in the scheme of things, not as a plug, but partially as a plug, you know, I relaunched my Substack for real this time.
Oh, good.
Yeah, the people at Substack were very kind and, you know, helped me out and convinced me to take it seriously. The founders are great people.
Yeah.
And they had been nagging me to take it seriously for a long time. And they're finally, I don't know if this is actually true, but I suspect they're like, we finally got him where we want him. He can't go back to tech. Hit him with the offer now. He's going to accept for sure.
Okay.
And they did. I mean, they're great guys. They're super on the ball too. So yeah, so I restarted the Substack in a serious way. That's my full-time job now, which I've just accepted. I know you talk about issues often on this podcast about, you know, and your own history with addictions. But, you know, my own personal history, I mean, some of your listeners might have been readers. I published this book, Chaos Monkeys, in 2016 that did very well, bestseller list for a month, you know, book of the year, NPR, Wired, all these mainstream outlets, which is funny that now you reread passages and it's considered, you know, the most abusive thing in the history of the world. But in any case, that book came out. And then, you know, I became kind of a full-time writer, person living in, like, the spectacle, as they call it, capital P, capital S, which, I mean, you do as well right here. In this world, you're tweeting for a living. It's just bizarre.
That what they call it?
That's
how you call it.
Well, there's a book called The Society of Spectacle from Guy Debord, who was sort of a 60s Marxist theorist. And it's these sort of almost oracular aphorisms about the world in that sort of French philosopher sort of way. And a number of them are actually very prescient in the sense that, you know, he saw what the image was doing to the world of text. And as many like Marshall McLuhan or Postman, right, like, you know, we think that what we're going through now is so dramatic, but in some sense, it's the final innings in a longer process. And in some sense, the disruption was more obvious when you went from a non-media world to a media world.
Right.
So anyhow, he has a bunch of pronouncements there that could have been, they're short, so they're almost like tweet length. And they could be tweets, you know, that somebody tweeted yesterday, but they were actually a French Marxist in the 60s. But in any case, he called the Society of Spectacles more or less what we live in now, which in society has become a series of images, effectively.
I want to read this.
It's not bad. Yeah. Just Google it. It's online. And, you know, it's not a book you read start to end. It's almost like Montesquieu's fables or you know, whatever. It's, but anyway, I call it the spectacle. Like, what else do you call this, Bridget? That, you know, we do this thing called a podcast.
Yeah,
we tweet,
I know. It's crazy.
And then you can make a living off of it, right?
No, I think about how weird this is. I'll, like, right. Overthink it. It's right. Like, what, this is just so weird, and I'm very grateful for it. But I always just refer to it as, like, the discourse TM, you know? It's like the culture or whatever. I don't really know. And I didn't come from, you know, political science background. I really just stumbled my way into it. And so I feel like I have I'm definitely like the everyman who stumbled into like the French court. I'm like, what are all you idiots talking about?
Well, but that's part of your genius. I mean, I think it's part of Rogan's genius as well, right? That he, you know, he just goes into a thing and puts people at their ease and gets them to open up and chat. And that is valuable in many ways.
So. Yeah, it's valuable, but I still think that I've spent most of the last 5 years being like, what the hell is going on? You know, even in the kitchen before we started talking, I'm like, what is happening? I always joke, I have this joke that I really want to do on stage, but I do it all the time in my dumb dumpster fire show about how, you know, the Twitter prompt is what is happening, but right. They totally misread it. It's actually, what is happening?
Exactly. Like, just WTF, right? Question mark. Yeah. It's weird. I mean, I tweeted it today. I think, and it's funny, I always joke, I'm not really a narcissist, I just play it on the internet. And so I think the only way to actually quote cope with being a professional narcissist is flipping the other way and going full solipsist. Like, my brain is the only thing in existence. Everybody, including you, Bridget, I'm sorry to say, is actually a projection of my subconscious. You're all NPCs in a personal video game. And I just, that's the only way I can rock it. Otherwise, I think I'll literally go crazy. Because to wrap up my earlier, you know, anecdote, I was literally, like, medicated insane at the end of my writer period. I was living alone in this off-grid cabin yurt thing up in the Northwest.
Oh, wow.
My family was in San Francisco. There was a second book deal in the offing. My agent's like, where's the book? I was spending too long on Twitter, you know, the occasional pieces for Wired or Guardian or whatever. But yeah, I literally went insane and I was on like benzodiazepines and SSRIs and shit by the end of it. I'm like, I need to go back to tech and do something real. This world of images is a funhouse mirror. It's a labyrinth. I have gotten lost in it. I will die here. I must exit. And
and now you're back.
And now I'm back. And I've had friends. And friends who knew me during that time have warned me. I think this is really a bad idea. But we'll see. Hopefully, maybe this time I'll grapple with it differently than I did.
I mean, I feel pretty insane. Definitely. After only 5 years of it. You know, I look at people who have been in this space for like decades. I'm like, oh my God. How are you not a crazy person?
I think they are. I think everyone is mentally ill. And the key thing in our society is being mentally ill in the correct remunerative ways. You can't be mentally ill in the wrong ways. Like people like, particularly in tech, not to be like Mr. Tech Guy, but if you talk to a lot of startup founders, they're all lunatics. Elon Musk is a lunatic. Mark Zuckerberg was a lunatic. They're all lunatics. And I don't think they're unique. Like, you know, the founders, Alexander Graham Bell was a lunatic. You know, Charles Goodyear of the vulcanization process was a lunatic. Eastman, the founder of Kodak, was a lunatic. So I think this is a common thing. And then everyone in media is basically a lunatic. I mean, you have to be. I don't know how you could be sort of a normal person. There might be strange, there might be weird exceptions.
But so we really are just in a giant mental ward.
That's right. It's not quite clear what to do about it. I mean, I think this is the bigger picture. I mean, I don't know how, like, 30,000 foot view. I can swear I've had no pot, but I think we need cultural adaptation to tech, like regulation, new algorithms. None of that's going to change anything. I think humanity has to get their head around the fact that, like, everyone can talk to me via this little device that I'm holding up, which is my smartphone. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's eyes and ears are in my pocket, and I'm in everybody's pocket, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is not something that Homo sapiens sapiens has been adapted to understand.
Right.
And nor have our institutions been adapted to sort of grapple with that. Anyway, I don't know if you want to go there, but...
I do. I love this conversation. I mean, I think about this all the time because I once had somebody on a podcast, an old podcast that I did, the first one I did, called Benched with an old comedian friend, and we talked about, like, we were both in our 40s and just kind of, or in our late 30s and divorced, and we were, like, talking about dating. We talked to people about their dating life. But somebody came on and was talking about tech and saying that it was, like, you know, boomers had no antibodies to it, and that's why they fall for every freaking thing that comes their way. And then us and Gen X, we came of age around the time tech... Like, I got an email address my senior year, basically, of high school.
Right.
And then, so we have a little bit of exposure to it, but we're considered the skeptical generation because we're the last generation that remembers life without it.
Right.
Analog. And then I did a roundtable with my nephews who were born with phones in their hands, basically, and it's fascinating to talk to them. They have so much more of an immunity to it.
Yeah.
But they also, it's weird because there's this whole cultural thing with the younger generation because they are better at tech than their parents. They think they're smarter than their parents about just everything in general.
Right.
Which makes sense when you're a kid.
Yeah.
Not until you're older do you respect wisdom. And so as a child, you're like, my dad's an idiot. He doesn't know how to program a TiVo.
Right.
What can I possibly learn from him? I'm filming him, teaching him how to use Zoom.
No, yeah, I've often had that experience. Also, like, with boomers, odd thing, but I used to sail a lot. I used to live on a boat, and, like, the sailing world, there's not a lot of young people in it. It's like, I was always the youngest person on the docks. It's typically, like, a boomer thing.
Yeah.
And this isn't fancy yacht club stuff, just to be clear. It's like, you know, older used boats. Like, there's a whole boating world that's not super fancy or anything, right? But it tends to be boomers who are doing it for retirement or whatever. And you talk to boomers, and it's like, man, they come off as, like, so naive and, like, a little slow. But then you realize they possess all sorts of virtues that the current generation does not, that allows them to do things like sail a sailboat across the ocean, which
right.
Me and my boyfriends have done. And I can't even imagine the younger generation, like, even getting their heads around to do it. And so, yeah, no, I agree. It's
although I will say my nephew, who is Gen Z, is in sailing. And
is he?
He's, like, wow. Super into it. Tons of his friends are into it. And he, when we did our round table, we did screen times, and he had the lowest screen time, and he was 17 at the time.
Where does he sail?
On the East Coast.
Okay.
And he's just very of this world. You know, he likes to be in the world, so he's really restless, so nothing holds his attention online.
Yeah, I think that's, the friends that I've seen that have actually coped with this have a rich in-person personal life, and, like, the internet is still just, like, one thing that people in the bridge generation like us can maybe convey to the next generation is that the internet didn't used to be this all-consuming thing. It's like a thing that you, that you like logged in and did and kind of like went away and did something else.
Because it took forever.
It was not the prism through which you saw all of reality. Right. It was just like, it was like making a phone call. It was like a subset of reality that, you know, fit a certain purpose, but wasn't everything. And so, the people I think who deal normally is like somebody like your nephew. Your nephew who has a rich social life. I think Bari actually mentioned in your podcast that she has a rich social and personal life that's kind of outside of the Twitter sphere, which keeps you sane. Or I think you've got people, I definitely have friends, and they tend to be of the techie, somewhat on the spectrum side, who are totally digital native, even though they might be our age. And they just, like, I'm literally quoting somebody, like, anything worth doing can be done better on the screen. That's just their attitude. And they just live in that, and like, I mean, they get exercise. They're not like, you know,
like
somebody.
Brains in a jar.
Not, right. They're not like, you know, some basement dweller who weighs 500 pounds or something. Like, they're relatively normal people. But beyond like basic maintenance and maintaining their families, they could stay 18 hours connected to like the board. And that's fine. That is their entire life. And they're just totally native to that. And it's, I can do that too. But again, I think that's when it drives me crazy. It's weird. I don't know what we're doing here. We're just creating a generation of people who are either driven crazy by the internet or ignore it or just live totally inside it and are ready for the singularity. It's it. I'm going to just live, you know, on a hard drive.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because then the pandemic accelerated this.
Exactly.
So now we have this process that's already happening, and then the pandemic forced everybody online. And in some ways, you know, I saw this with like 12 Steps. It was really interesting because they adapted so quickly and they had 12-step meetings online, but we were joking the other day, like, why didn't we always have that?
so you felt it improved the interaction in that?
Well, I think we had to do it just for, they were already doing it in London and Italy and because obviously this hit. So that I think the European 12-step community basically showed us what to do over here. And I was already going to Italian meetings and stuff like that when the pandemic was just ravaging Italy in the first wave because my old sponsor from here now lives in Rome. And I was like, cool, I get to see you. This is awesome. So then and that's why I was like overly obsessed with all of this stuff, even in February. And I was like, this shit's coming. And then we started doing meetings, and I was like, this is awesome. I can see my friends in New York. I could go to meetings in London. It was really cool. And everyone's like, look at how resilient we are in these 12-step programs. But when I see how it gave access to so many people, I was like, yeah, but why weren't we already doing this? Like, in some ways, it showed me just how, like, addicts literally have to be backed into a corner before they do anything. Because it seems natural to me that that would be something that existed, and it did not exist until the pandemic.
But yeah, that's right. But, you know, is it just addicts, though? Like, one of the things that's been interesting to see is to see my tech community of peers, how they dealt with the pandemic. And the feeling I was getting, like, 4 months into it, and, like, the narrative was still, like, the world is ending or whatever, right? It was like, man, a lot of people are actually doing very well. And actually, I ran a Twitter poll, like, probably a year ago now, or maybe 9 months ago, that was like, has COVID improved your life, stayed the same, sucks, ruined it, right? 35%, which admittedly my followership is probably heavily biased in one direction, but 35% said COVID actually improved their lives.
Right.
And the people who I saw grapple.
Pajama jobbers.
Right. Although, but they weren't total pajama type people, right? Like they had, the people who actually did really well, many of them left San Francisco or California. So they went to Utah, Texas, Florida, whatever. But there were self-directed people who had their own family who were kind of empowered to like go and do their jobs from wherever. And then, you know, Tyler Cohen in a very dismissive way called this like COVID was a great intelligence test, right? Suddenly, assuming you had a white collar profession, you could just stay at home, right?
Right.
And then like, well, does it ruin your life or do you turn what was like a downside into an upside?
Right.
And for a lot of my friends, it became an upside. And a lot of them moved away and I think are never moving back. I don't think they're coming back to San Francisco. Right. Not everybody, but a lot of them. And, you know, they just was like, yeah, I don't need to, I do my job. It's all Zoom. It's all virtual. And I have time with my family, and that's it. I don't need anything else. I don't need to go out for drinks and this and that. And it sounds a little bit antisocial, but I don't know. They seem to love it. And I'm undecided on it because I don't have such a rich, stable home life. But for a lot of people, decoupling where you work and how you live and your family situation was a huge boon. And I think that's big, right? Decoupling how you pay the bills and where you pay the bills, right?
Yeah.
Not just like for the global wealthy who could always do that, but like, you know, for your average little pixel pusher, you know, white collar person, that's a big change.
Yeah. I mean, I remember early in the pandemic walking around LA and noticing families having dinners together. And yeah. I was like, I either never noticed it or I've just never seen so many families sitting down to dinner together. And I'm sure people, because it's a grind in these cities. So, you know, dad's off at work and traveling. And when everybody was home, there was more. I saw families out bike riding and there wasn't really much we could do here. And I'm really interested in seeing like the divorce rates and stuff like this coming in the following year. So this show Sex Life came out recently on Netflix.
Okay.
And
I've had the pleasure of seeing Sex Life.
It's a show about... It's my friend's in it, and it's a show about a woman who's choosing between like her old wild kind of flame and she's in this marriage that's kind of boring. And I was like, whatever. This seems so basic, you know. I was right. Like, okay, cool. Seems basic. I thought people would like it because there's tons of sex in it and they've been locked up. But I cannot tell you how many women have called me and talked to me and are like, I'm leaving my husband. I can't. I'm watching Sex Life. I can't watch Sex Life. I was like, what is going on in America? I don't know what it's tapping into, but it's tapping into something crazy in the female population of this country that I didn't even know was there.
Yeah, I think, I mean, getting back to the COVID thing, I'll address the Sex Life thing, but the COVID thing I think is going to have, could potentially have lots of long range ramifications from where people live to even domestic architecture, right? Like I've been shopping around for houses off and on in different places. And just like the concept of the Zoom room is now a thing real estate brokers pitch. It's like, this is the Zoom room. It's not like the study, the den, the whatever, like the five or six rooms that classically sort of define the middle-class home. No, this is the Zoom room now.
That's crazy.
And the fact that people are like designing their homes to be partially private, partially public spaces, which, you know, is how people often used to live. Roman aristocrats would like do their business at home. Or, you know, whatever, you know, the wealthy watch titans or whatever used to have like their study where they would take meetings or whatever. But now that's, you don't have a room where you would take meetings, but you have a Zoom room in which you do work at home and you have to separate sort of your personal life from that. So it's interesting. And then the Sex Life thing, I don't know. You know, it's weird. I think what might be the problem, it's like, it's imagine you change the rules of football such that you couldn't throw the ball, right? Who you'd actually have in your team would radically change, right?
Right.
Like, well, okay, we don't need the quarterback with the throwing arm anymore. We need like a bunch of running backs or whatever. So if you're living in a world in which you're actually having dinner with this person every day, maybe you would select a different mate. So it's not as if it's the death of marriage necessarily. It's just like that husband under those conditions, you know, that you used to marry. Now you don't want to see that guy's face anymore. You pick somebody else. I don't know. I'm trying to be optimistic.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy because I was talking to my therapist about this too. And she was saying that it either from just her perspective as a like marriage counselor as well, she was like, it seems like it's either strengthened right. your marriage or it ended it. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of, you know, in between. Like you either got stronger as a couple and it bonded you or it was like, I can't do this anymore. Because I think a lot of people were in relationships where their work kept them separate and enough that they were like, I'll just endure. And the minute they were locked in a house together, it was like, nope. I wonder about like the 3 million kids they estimate that fell through the cracks with the schools. The whole school thing has been, how old are your kids?
They are 5, 9, and 11.
Okay, so they're in the school ages. I think it was really hard on the kids.
Yeah, and on the parents. And that's another thing. A lot of these people that I just mentioned who left California very self-directed, they've kind of given up on the schools. And I mean, they're seeing what's being taught on Zoom for the first time. And they're seeing how effective it is, and often it's effective, often usually it's not. And so, like, it's a lot of conversations with homeschooling and stuff that I'm hearing now.
Yeah.
Or tutors or, like, unconventional software, but whatever. But just conventional 30 kids in a room sitting there listening to a teacher drawing on. Even if the school's open, it doesn't seem to be like the default anymore.
That's crazy. I'm like, didn't you know this is what was going on in your kid's school? Like, how did you not know this is what school was? It literally hasn't changed since we were in school.
Right.
It's the same thing. Maybe worse. Just kind of maybe gotten worse. But yeah, that's been interesting to me to hear too, where parents are like, I can't believe what these kids are being taught. And a lot of people, I heard this, and particularly from San Francisco, are leaving because of the school situation, which part of me understands. Like, you want to vote with your feet or whatever, but part of me gets mad because I hope it's not the people who voted for all of this stuff abandoning it.
No. Indirectly, perhaps, but I think, yeah, it's weird. I think, you know, well, to the extent that I understand SF politics, I called in some of the famism calls with SFUSD. I don't know how much
I remember,
it,
yeah.
Back in the day, I remember my one SF kid isn't even in the public school, so I'm really kind of seeing it as a tourist almost. But a friend of mine is heavily engaged in that and is on the other side of most of those debates and is blocked by all the board members on Twitter and all this stuff. And so, when she would go on, she'd say, hey, here's the Zoom link. I'm like, okay, fine, I'll go watch it. And it was like, you know, Jerry Springer, but sad, right? Because it was just like, it was these board members who are obviously very ideological, who don't seem motivated to actually, like, find a solution to this obvious problem. And it was specifically around the Lowell thing. So Lowell is like the prestige high school, which is, you know, it's an elite school, but it's a public school, and it's admissions only. It's hard to get in, right? But it's like, it's kind of like Berkeley inside the UC system, right?
Right.
It's supposed to be the sort of elite, but public university,
right?
And they just wrecked it. I mean, and it was obviously like a total political. It was like, oh, we can't hold the exam because of COVID. And then like cynics are like, oh, well, that's just an excuse. They're just going to kill it. And then true enough, within 6 to 9 months, they basically did. And they actually, on the calls, they had the parents. And it sounds a little pathetic, but realize like the kids' futures are at stake. So you can see why they'd pull out the emotional stops. They put the kid on the call. Like an eighth grader's like, yeah, I studied, you know, and I really got into this. And I remember one kid, God, it was so sad. I almost wanted to cry. It's like, you know, my parents, like, we just don't have a lot. And this is my one chance at, like, getting, like, a real education.
Yeah.
Like, on the con. It's like, oh, my God. And then, of course, they just crushed it. They didn't care. It's like, oh, my God, this is so horrible.
It's so horrible. These school boards are out of control.
Yeah. And, they seem completely unaccountable. And that, well, now there's a recall thing going on.
I know. I saw that. A couple of those SF school board members, like three, I believe.
Yeah, they're trying to recall Chessa, who's the DA, and then three of the school board members. It's interesting because I was actually listening to David Sachs, who's a prominent SFUC, and we're on talking about a lot of these efforts. He's actually backing the recall efforts, and there's other tech billionaires funding the anti-recall efforts. And so in some sense, it's actually split in many ways, kind of the big money people in the city. And so it really has divided. I, for the record, have signed the recall. So anyhow, it's this bizarre dust up. And it's, you know, it's interesting that, like, typically SF has had corruption and incompetence forever. It's always been the case. If you actually read the deep history of much of San Francisco, it's just full of corruption and incompetence. Mm-hmm. It always has been. But in this case, it's like they went a step too far. Once the kids are involved, then it's when parents who might normally just, like, shrug their shoulders and not care, that's when they revolt, which reminded me, it's funny, in 1960s Cuba, when the revolution came, it went Soviet and communist and hard-edged very, very quickly. And, there were rumors going around that the kids would be sent to education camps, or at the very least put in these little pioneer camps, which is like the socialist youth, which they were. And that's when the parents freaked out. That's when they grabbed my parents, for example, literally, and like bought them tickets to Miami. Like, my grandparents couldn't get out. They put the kids on the plane and sent them alone to the United States. Tens of thousands. There's a whole thing called Pedro Pan, the Peter Pan thing. Probably one of the biggest movements of refugee children since like World War II, probably. Tens of thousands of kids were sent, often alone, to the United States. Some were actually cared for by the Catholic Church. Some were, in the case of my parents, they had distant family in the United States, so they were actually, you know, distant cousins or uncles housed them when they landed, so they didn't have to go to, like, the orphanage and the Catholic school. But in any case, it was, that whole wave happened when, you know, they kind of came for the kids, right?
Mm.
And not that I'm equating what happened in communist Cuba with what's happening in San Francisco, though, frankly, they're probably not as far apart as you might guess. But the fact that the state comes for your kids and says, well, we're either not going to educate them and do what we should be doing, which is opening schools, or we're going to educate them in this weird way, and then suddenly, boom, parents freak out, which would explain a lot of the kickback to this CRT business and a lot of these school board hearings you're seeing where parents are getting arrested, screaming and yelling at the school board. Like, I think something about the children touches you in a primal way.
It's interesting watching the CRT debate go just, like, mainstream in the past couple of weeks. It's driven me off Twitter. I'm like, I'm out. I can't. I'm out of this conversation. You know, do you ban it? All these things. And I'm glad to see parents pushing back. You know, I'm grateful to see parents who are like, okay, enough. And I do think that, like, in California, it's crazy. I don't know. Are they going back to school in the fall? I don't even know if they're... No. Yeah, I don't know that they're gearing up for it. It's.
I mean, my kid is, but she goes to a private school. So it's to specifically not have to deal with this sort of thing.
Yeah, it's so wild. But I just feel, this is what I've been saying this whole time, is these kinds of mechanisms and lockdowns, it just seems like it hurts the kids who need the help the most and who need the structure or the school or the lunches or whatever. I don't know. I get really disheartened with all of it. I don't understand the people who are saying, like, we care about the children so much, we're going to keep the schools closed forever.
Well, those are the teachers' unions talking. Yeah.
But it's so, and it's frustrating because I think teachers get, you know, bad. I really think people need to take more aim at the teachers' unions and less at the teachers, because they're like on freaking, they're fundraising on GoFundMe every year. It's like, hey, here's, please give us money, because I guess all the money goes to administration now or something. I don't get it. I don't understand anything. All I've learned in the past 5 years is that I literally don't understand how anything works. And it's a miracle that this country even functions at all based on what I've seen, particularly in the past year.
Yeah, I mean, there are some positives, though. The vaccine development was incredibly fast.
Yeah, that was cool.
And, in fact, the U.S., once it finally got its ass in gear, the rollout was actually remarkably fast and beat the EU by a lot. Not quite as fast as Israel, but... I think we can often be a little bit too pessimistic. And also, like, the U.S. is a varied place, right? Like, I don't know that the lockdowns were mismanaged as much in other states as they were in California.
No, they weren't. It's like going to another world. I was just in Nashville, and it's literally, like, another country completely.
Right. But the narrative in the sort of more blue states is that, like, the red states are just suffering through. It's like, well, it doesn't quite seem to be. I go to Nevada, and things are just fine.
Yeah.
I cross the border back to California, things are different. So, yeah.
Although it does feel like a little bit more normalcy is coming back.
Yes, finally.
I was at the Hollywood Bowl on the 4th of July. There was no, you know, you didn't have to be vaccinated or show proof of it. Everybody was chill. If you wanted to wear a mask, okay. But most of the people weren't. It was a very joyous time.
There's still lines on the block for the fancy brunch places in San Francisco. I mean, nature is healing. Clearly.
It's so wild. I don't know. I've been working on my dumb book forever.
Oh, what's this book?
The Accidental Pundit. Okay. It's about how, it's just the story of like how an idiot tweeted her way into the center of the culture wars. And I just happened to be like in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time, depending on how you view it.
Bridget, you're way underselling yourself. You're not the accidental pundit. You're the providential woman who just walked into the debate and said exactly what needed to be said.
No.
To move the debate in the right direction.
No. I actually yesterday was like, what am I doing? I feel like I was having the existential crisis that you described up in the woods.
Yeah.
Where I was like, what the fuck am I doing? I was seriously like, I want to go back to waiting tables. At least it's in the world.
Yeah.
And that's at least it's like interacting with real people, and there's a wait staff shortage.
There definitely is. It's funny, you drive around rural America, there's help wanted signs everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
well, I read this cool article about how teens are really capitalizing on this.
Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, sure.
They're normally getting, you know, booted out of the job market, and now they're like, please, teen. I think Gen Z is pretty dope. I have a lot of hope for them, other than the Gen Z kids that are on TikTok. They worry me.
They're hopeless. Okay. TikTok. Do you think TikTok is just the death of Western intellectual life?
I don't. It's weird. The whole vibe of it creeps me out. You know, there's like the little soldiers repeating these like long, short clipped kind of mantras of like these like long lectures that they do in this very weird clip. And edit in this kind of strange way. And even though scrolling, just how you can just go and go and go until, as my husband says, your brain turns into pudding.
Yeah.
It's just...
True, but some of the shots are actually very clever.
Yeah.
So the
current... Some of the stuff is crazy good.
Right. Some of it's crazy. I get sent from friends who are big TikTokers, and some of them are actually super brilliant.
Like, yeah.
Actually, you know, inspired. What's weird about it, this is one of the things that one of the bees that has flown into my bonnet that just will not fly out is like, you know, textual versus visual or oral culture, right? Which is, I'm not going to give the whole spiel that I usually give here, but, you know, it's a different way of looking at the world to interact as we are, you know, face-to-face, oral culture, we personally know each other, body language, et cetera, versus reading, you know, a 6,000-word wall of text in The New Yorker, which nobody does anymore. Nobody actually reads The New Yorker. Even The New Yorker writes probably over.
And did so, anyone read The New Yorker?
Yeah, you have to read the cooperate with the umlaut to pronounce it correctly. It's funny, when The New Yorker Union was striking, they actually used an umlaut in cooperate, like in the sign. It was like, oh my God, it's so ridiculous. Like nobody else in the Western, in the English-speaking Western world puts an umlaut in cooperate. And they do, and they did it in the sign. But in any case, getting back to the visual thing, you know, I remember, again, we're part of the bridge generation. So I'm sure you remember when you're, I remember when I was in elementary school, that like the original memes, like some verbal tic, or some cute way of phrasing something, or some little three-second act you would do, like the equivalent of a TikTok video, would just catch fire throughout the entire school, or even the entire, like Miami, I was raised in Miami, which is like a bit of a linguistic bubble, because it had a lot of Hispanic culture, but English, and just kind of isolated from other cities. And so like, I just recall things would just take over the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And TikTok is just the digital shareable version of that. So
yeah.
I don't know that it's that different, but I think what where your brain does get obviously subverted is where you're seeing like 1,000 of them at once. When we were kids, you would see 3 or 4 of those a day or whatever. It would just be kind of different. So I don't know. I'm maybe not. I do think that the oral mind, the mind that interacts via that mechanism is very different than the one that can actually look at text. And so the one thing I wonder about, getting back to your point about like, are we going to adapt to like the internet as it is? And like the boomers seem dumb, right? They seem tech dumb. But that said, guess what? They make, you know, they created the world whose ruins arguably we're living in, right? Can you maintain the world as we know it today with the new internet mind? That's where I'm kind of dubious, right? Like I'm not sure that you can maintain, you know, the nation state came out of the Enlightenment in textual culture, right? Before that, the notion of having one body of law and one nominal people, a sort of a force concept, over, you know, 4 time zones with populations in the millions, was kind of a novel concept, right?
Right.
You had a sort of feudal patchwork of allegiances. It was very different, right? And so can you maintain that, right, in a world where, yeah, people interact with you TikTok. I don't know, right?
I mean, I saw some that were just genius where they were layering on top of each other, and there was the one that went viral that was really cool where they just turned it into, like, a hostage situation by the end, and it was just really creative and cool, and I think that I'm not one of those people who are like, the kids these days, because I feel like every generation feels that way.
But how do you convey, like, a serious thought beyond a TikTok that way?
No, my sister was like, my kids have no attention span. None.
Right.
She was like, their attention span is... She's like, they don't watch TV. TV's done. Once TV comes to Gen Z or whatever, she's like, they don't... And to them, sitting in front of a television is like our version of having a landline. It's
right.
like a stagnant piece of technology that at least with... And I was thinking about this. At least with technology, it's interactive. I don't know if that's good or bad, but television is so passive. You're just like being programmed. Whereas I think with the younger generation, they're interacting much more. They have friends. But my sister was like, ah, the preteen drama online is like take normal junior high and then extrapolate that to exponential levels of the internet. And so, and I don't think kids see any point in learning just for the sake of learning. You know, like memorizing things, they're like, why would I do this? They did this study years ago on kids. They said, here's the information you need to know. Here's where you can find it, and here's what the information is. And all the kids, it was something like 90% of the kids remembered where to go look for the information as opposed to what the information was.
That's probably right. I mean, I remember back, again, in the analog days, a lot of exams were basically information retrieval and recall, which I don't know how much value it has, but... The problem there is probably with the testing, right? That's a very crude way. Like if I gave you like a quiz for a book, right? I would literally ask you the 4 things that factually you would need to know. While I think reading a book and actually slogging through 300 pages of text or anacrandon or whatever, it shapes your mind in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
As an intellectual exercise, like you are literally compiling language code and recreating it in your brain rather than just like staring at pixels. And two, to the degree that you can actually develop empathy with, I don't know why I picked Anna Karenina out of the air, but Anna Karenina's plight and why she might throw herself in front of the train out of her love. Right?
Spoiler alert.
So, sorry. I know that season didn't quite come out yet. But it might be a surprise for some of you. But she dies at the end. Sorry. But that, you know, that's a mental exercise that I think it's hard to do otherwise.
And yeah.
That's some aspect of learning.
I have trouble doing it now. If I didn't have this podcast and people who write books, I'd be worried about my ability to still read a book. It takes I've noticed this. I've started noticing what happens when I sit down to read a book now. And it takes me probably 10 to 15 minutes of reading the same sentence maybe 15 times before my brain clicks into reading mode, and then I can let myself be absorbed by the book. But it, I do feel my brain switching from some other operating system to reading a book operating system.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, and again, I hate just banging on this thing, but this is my second book idea, the question of, like, oral culture, how is visual culture, how is it different, right? It's very emotive, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you get sucked into that TikTok or, like, the one little viral clip of Daniel Craig saying it's the weekend or whatever, which has gone to the It's literally fucking 5 seconds, and the guy just says it's the weekend.
And it's just somehow, the way he said it.
Right, it's the tone, it's his look, because he's this dashing dude. Like, something about it just engages you in an emotional memory. Like, even now, I'm replaying in my head. But
because he's so, like... you want him to go, it's the weekend, but he's like, it's the weekend.
Right, he's somewhat exhausted in it, right? Yeah. It's like, yes, where's my pint? Yeah, exactly. But that's great in a way, and there's great things about all culture, but in some sense, it's hard to analyze facts in a disinterested way, right? Like, objective reality, like, let's go look something up in the sense of, like, there's an external description of reality, or there's an external opinion about the world that I just judge and evaluate without necessarily viscerally, emotively, you know, engaging with it. That's hard to do through visual media, right? Like, it's hard to, I don't know, see somebody giving a speech and not see your pulse quicken or feel feelings of disgust or whatever. One thing I find strange is that there's so many things going on in the world that if they can't be sort of reconciled into this dialogue of, like, CRT is
the
bad
binary.
Or CRT is good or whatever the hell the case may be, where there's this set of people on this side and this set of people on this side yelling, if you can't project it into what are, frankly, fairly simplistic narratives, like, it doesn't exist, right? So, like, to cite one example, this week, the president of Haiti was, like, whacked.
This
like, literally
is crazy
assassinated.
Me.
Like, a bunch of mercenaries showed up at the presidential palace.
They were, like, Colombian and American.
Right.
Yeah.
One guy was caught on video with an American accent. It was very clearly an American. Although, I think they were
pretending... I think they were Haitians who lived in America.
Yeah, they were Haitian Americans. And they're pretending to be a DEA operation or something. So they kind of fooled the guards. And then they literally shot up the place and killed the president. And, you know, it got reported on. Again, it's not like I'm alleging some sort of media cover-up conspiracy. But it just didn't play... in that oral sort of discourse that we're part of, that is the conversation. Like, Twitter is the conversation, let's face it. Like, getting on the cover of the New York Times, like, doesn't matter unless, in some sense, it reveals itself into the Twitter discourse and all the downstream stuff from there. Another example I cited was the building collapse in Miami, which, you know, big deal, major tragedy, 150 Americans or more dead. And, like, it got reported on, again, it was on CNN, but it didn't really play until it kind of got fed into either the climate change Florida narrative, or DeSantis, who obviously has presidential aspirations, or whatever, then it could somehow be reconciled into that, into the epic poetry of fighting over DeSantis in Florida, or fighting over COVID, or fighting over climate change.
Right.
Then it could be sort of parsed. But as like, okay, how the hell is it that like a poured concrete rebar building in a major American city just pancakes, right? Like that is a question that's going to be handled by structural engineers or, you know, whatever local, Miami Herald, the local paper, obviously have very good reporting on, of like, how is it like in the permitting process and the maintenance process that you get to a point where a building just collapses, right? But that's a very different conversation, right?
And it's boring.
It's
boring.
It's boring if it's not your family that's in the rubble.
Right. You know, like it's boring details of like, it's like, any of these conversations that I think are really important and really matter.
But that was exactly Plato's critique, right? That Twitter is so amusing that if you don't have that emotional, visceral pull to the story, you'll just ignore it. And that's exactly what's happening.
I'm guilty of adding to this garbage. I love this podcast because it's like the yin to my dumpster fire, which really was me. I'm like, I need to take my Twitter account and turn it into a show because I feel like people aren't hearing. I hear all the time on Twitter, they're like, I can hear you saying this. And that was the exact reason I started Dumpster Fire, because I was like, I don't think people are hearing the tone in which I'm writing,
right?
Which is very tongue in cheek 90% of the time.
Well, that's the other thing, right? Like I said, Twitter is oral media until it isn't, right?
Right.
Then it's like textual media, then it sucks. Because again, if you were like, I've often said that like we could, all the nastiness on Twitter could be like cut down by one of two things. Either having there be like a binding duel button. Like someone insults me and it's like, okay, I press this button, you opt in, and it's pistols at dawn, right? Like, then that's it, motherfucker. Like, that's it. Forget blocking and canceling or whatever. We're just gonna, one of us will not come out of here alive. Or two, probably the nicer way to do this is like you instantly go to a 30-second video of the person like playing with their kids or speaking in a normal voice. And then it's like, oh my God, this is like a real person. The first time I realized that me, not that I'm much of anything online, but had left the orbit of like regular person who just tweets and no one gives a shit about to like this totemic thing, this avatar, this AGM brand that had nothing to do with the real me and that just meant something in people's minds and they're going to interact with that thing and not even think that there's like a human related to it. I think it was like when Prop C, this homelessness bill thing in SF was passed, and it was well into my writing career. Like I already had a byline, I had published a book, but it hadn't quite hit me. People were talking about me like in the third person or making me out to be some tech bro guy who literally wanted to like put, you know, homeless people in gulags or something, which of course was not what I was saying at all. I was just asking you a question about Prop C. And that's when it hit me that like, man, this is, it feels impromptu and personal and like you have access to like, you know, the Bridget brand or my or whatever, but it's not that at all, right? Like at some point, textual culture comes in. It's like, no, it's like a name. It's an abstract thing. It's not the real person.
Right.
And that's why I think it's often...
It's weird.
It's the union of worsts,
yes.
Right? It's like, it feels impromptu and informal and direct and emotional and agonistic, but then it's searchable, it's indexable. So like the embarrassing tweet from 6 years ago is going to get you canceled.
Right.
And there's that level of remove in which it's like, okay, I don't see this as a person anymore. I see it as a figurehead. Like, you know, the way that we would talk about Stalin, not consider his feelings, obviously, right? Or any figure, rather, the president or whatever, right? So yeah, that to me is why it's so dysfunctional. Not that I know how to fix it. I do think that things like, although it's kind of petered out a little bit, Clubhouse, for example, social audio, I think, which is
other. I thought Clubhouse was terrifying. I spent 2 days
really?
In there.
And what do you think?
I hated it.
Really? Why'd you hate it?
Because first of all, my joke was come for the group therapy, stay for the struggle session. Because I was in one room and it was like I think it was a pretty just generally woke room. And I was like, wow, this is like a zoo of the people on Twitter that I didn't actually think were real. So to your point of oral versus textual and the worst of both worlds, Clubhouse revealed to me that these people that I thought were parodies, and I was always like, no, these people are just, I'm imagining that they're worse than they are.
They're as bad as I thought.
And that was really distressing to me.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely know what you're talking about. I was in a few of those rooms.
Some girl got kicked out, and she came back in, and they allowed her to apologize after she got booted for suggesting that speech might not be violent. And then when they kicked her out, they all had a conversation about holding space, the like therapy language.
Yeah.
My husband, who's a therapist, is like, this is group therapy.
Yeah.
He's like, this is literally what it sounds like to run a group therapy session, only no one's running it. It's just people re-traumatizing each other in a dysfunctional group therapy session.
Yeah.
Then they let her back in. Then it became like a struggle session where she had to keep apologizing, but she didn't apologize the right way. I was like, this is fucking nuts. I didn't think this was actually real. And then I heard a couple of things like that. And then the anti-Semitism got crazy.
Oh, yeah. I was in that room. I remember that one.
There were a couple of rooms. And then I heard, like, then Brett was trying to be Weinstein had one room. And I was like, this is nuts, too. And then a lot of the other people who were in there, it felt like a lot of people who really loved hearing themselves talk.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Which was the other side of it. So then I would wander into rooms and I'm like, oh man, I cannot have. I also think something happened at the end of the Trump era where many of us who were in this space and pushing back against the left were having this conversation about cancel culture and to our detriment often. And then when Trump left, it became okay for a certain type of person who is in the mainstream media or was allowed to talk about these certain things, and then they started talking about them, and I was, like, already bored with this conversation. So I'm like, welcome to the party, guys. I'm glad to have you. I'm happy that you can just pivot out of, like, this is great for you that you get to talk about this now. And
well, Bridget, they were too busy in the resistance movement.
Yeah, but they weren't even really in the resistance. It was like, it was just people who were kind of like biding their time in their like legacy media jobs until they could fight the left, even though they were kind of not for the left the whole time. It was weird. So I was just bored. That's like the CRT thing. I'm like, I'm so bored. If I had kids, I'd be fighting this fight, but I don't have to care.
Yeah, I know. Well, neither do I, because I've kind of bought my way out of it, which is totally craven and cowardly, I know. But I don't know. I don't like the culture war. Like, there's certain aspects of it. Like, I did one piece on the whole Latinx thing, which I think is completely silly. And to some degree, I feel it's kind of my lane coming from an Hispanic background. So I did write about that. But more broadly, like, I just, it's, I can't deal with the grief. And I, you know, I don't even understand education. You know, one thing I think we should all do? We should all just, like, express fewer opinions. Like, there's a few things in the world that I feel I know about that I can add something new. And the rest of it, like, I have opinions because obviously I'm not, you know, I'm a private citizen with opinions. But I don't feel like, you know, I don't think they're unique or exceptional. Like, I don't need to share them. Like, yeah. I have an opinion on CRT. I'm not going to share it. I'm not going to claim I know and that you should listen to my opinion. I don't know. Whatever. Like, I just...
I don't know anything. I mean, I've been reading about it and learning about it. And I'm curious about... I like hearing both sides. There were some conversations I liked hearing. I really like getting out of the, like, discourse and into the stuff that I just knew nothing about. Those rooms were some... To me, it was like I'm at a convention center and I can pop into rooms and it's people having conversations. Like I always said, Twitter is like high school and Clubhouse is like the house party that the rich kid has. And you have to be invited to it. And there's all these different rooms with different things going on. Or it felt very much like a convention center where there was different conference, you know, different topics happening in different rooms.
But so, the reason I mentioned Clubhouse is a positive, though, is that it's a little bit better in that you do feel that human connection, for better or worse, right? Like, you can feel the quaver in the person's voice when they're on social audio. And, you know, most people aren't total sociopaths that they would sit there and troll somebody cruelly, like, hearing their voice and feeling some level of human connection. And also, there's good... See, the problem, I think, in the groups you're in, you need a good admin. You need, like, a bouncer in the bar who's like, all right, you, out of here. Or just, you're not invited up to begin with, right? Like, it's, in our social lives, we don't just let random strangers do a dinner party and, like, see what happens. It's like, no. And if you invite someone you know and they get out of hand, you kick them out, right? And then I think, you know, we should look to see the structures that we've built to, like, coordinate our real IRL lives. If you were to bake those into the mechanism of a lot of these apps, I think things would probably go a lot more smoothly.
But I don't know if people even want it. You know, I mean, here's my fear, and this is what I was saying in the kitchen before we started, is I think people have got addicted to certain things that are really bad, like fear being one of them, and I know that growing up in kind of a crazy environment, how hard it is to deprogram yourself from being addicted to that fight or flight or being addicted to dysfunction or whatever. So I think we were in a very dysfunctional cycle, obviously, that got... I was writing this book, and it's like, you could not write this script. If you were like, okay, yeah, we're going to have Trump be the president. All right, that's a little far-fetched, but okay. And then when the election year comes, there's going to be a global plan. You'd be like, get the fuck out of here. That's like, it's too crazy. I can't believe we lived through it. And I don't know that anyone's really processed it, and I don't think that people want to process it either. I mean, I know I'm not looking forward to 20 Netflix specials about comedians baking bread and, like, being in the pandemic. No one really wants to think about it. I think a lot of people are like, let's just move on. But the craziness seems really unleashed, too, in certain ways. I mean, I sometimes, like, with Dumpster Fire, because we just make fun of everything on Dumpster Fire, and particularly there's so much low-hanging fruit a lot of the times coming out of the left, just craziness.
Yeah.
And then we end up sounding like MAGA, you know? It's like,
or the Babylon Bee. Yeah.
Or the Babylon Bee, but it just, you end up, the binary has taken over everything. And I think people become addicted to, I worry, like fighting. Because why did Clubhouse peter out?
What is your theory? I think the lockdown just ended. People started seeing each other in real life. Or, I don't know, it's a good question. I still think social audio, there's something there that worked. That I think will Twitter Spaces is still going, right? I did a Twitter Spaces with Ben Thompson yesterday, and it was very well attended, big crowd, a lot of tech people from the FTC were there. So I think social audio does have a certain magic to it. I don't know. I think there'll be some version of it. I have no stake in the company, but David Sacks and the co-founders, I forget their name, started a company called Colin. It's kind of like Clubhouse, but it's almost like podcasting. You also have a link so you can share it later. That's, that was one of the problems with Clubhouse, is that, like, if you missed it, like, you missed it. Like, there's nothing to share. And so, I don't know. I think...
That was one of my issues with it, because people always invited me to rooms, and I was like, what exactly is the point for me to show up to this thing?
Right.
There's a high chance that I'll get in trouble for saying something, and there's a low reward. I'm not going to build my following. It's not marketing. It's essentially... not scalable.
Yeah, I mean, you sussed this out faster than I did. I hosted a show with a bunch of tech people, Mark Andreessen, Catherine Boyle, a bunch of other people. And it was great. We had people like Sam Harris on, and Matt Taibbi, and Tom Holland, like serious intellectuals and stuff, and like great combos, and it's all gone.
Yeah.
It's like that way. So yeah, clearly there's a hole in the product there.
Well, that's what I was saying. I'm like, if I could do walk-ins welcome live and have you sit on Clubhouse.
See, wouldn't that be cool?
And then do it and have an audience that was listening, and then you could do a Q&A afterwards with real people, and then I could record that. I would totally use Clubhouse.
This is going to be music to David Sachs' ears, because that's the company he funded. That's what I plan to do. So I did Twitter Spaces with Ben Thompson, this guy named Eric Suford, who's a big blogger in the mobile tech space. Ben Thompson, as people probably know, is author of Stratechery, who kind of invented the paid newsletter model, and has a huge following in the tech space. He's a little wonky, insider-ish thing, but he's done very well for himself. He created a Substack before there was a Substack.
Right.
So, anyways, we did Twitter Spaces, and I just discovered a follower told me that when you download your Twitter data, as part of it, you actually get the MP3 file for your Twitter space, at least for the 30 days after it. So I'll probably actually end up posting it. But it's that idea that you're saying, which is, we had a great convo, informal, you know, on the fly sort of thing. It'd be great to have a link to share it. And so, we'll see. I'm sure the innovation machine will kick in.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I was like, hey, if I could turn this into content, then I'd be all over it. But it's really just like me attending something to what?
Right. Yeah. Do you feel, just out of curiosity, I mean, this is a little meta because we were talking about a podcast. I mean, do you feel that you do a lot of editing and stuff, or that you would rather go the other way and be more improvisational and just have like a walk-in thing, jam for 2 hours and just post it and that's it?
I mean, we do not a lot of editing on this. So we'll try and make people sound better with O's, ums, whatever. If people are sick, I know how comfortable you can get on a podcast. I want to give people always the opportunity to feel safe. And if there's something that they regretted saying or that they just really didn't want public, I just always offer that to any of my guests because I know how it is. It's happened to me where I'm like, that feeling of dread where you leave a podcast, you're like, oh, shit, what did I say? And we do same thing with Dumpster Fire. We do one take. We don't stop and re-say things. Maybe we will a little bit, but I want to take Dumpster Fire on the road and do Dumpster Fire live. So my rule has always been one take, 1 hour. We treat this like a show because we're not going to have this. I don't want to get in the habit of being like, it would be annoying for an audience to.
No transcription, no text. Like you don't transcribe.
I know. For which one?
Well, either one. I guess Dumpster Fire, the one you're talking about.
What do you mean?
Like, well, you know, a lot of podcasts, you know, that's the thing. Like, podcasts seem like they're audio culture. I sound like a maniac, but often they're kind of textual in that A, they're edited and presented, and there's usually an agenda. And then two, there's a transcription. People can actually just read the podcast.
We do transcriptions of our podcasts. I think we're a little behind, but just for the deaf community. And so we try to keep up on that so that people and it's just whatever. And then with Dumpster Fire, I mean, the thing is people will also just do it for you. You know, you can get a transcription because you have like crazy people who will do that. Dumpster Fire, no, we don't do that yet. It's Dumpster Fire should be a podcast as well. We just haven't had the time, the bandwidth to like take the audio and upload it. It's really because it was such a visual medium for me, just me being performing, that I'm like, you lose so much. And we make so many jokes and we use text a lot where we'll editorial, because I can't fact check myself, so we'll fact check me afterwards, and I'm often getting things wrong or saying the wrong word or the wrong date. And so then we make a joke about me being an idiot usually, and it's a visual joke, which you would totally...
You put captions underneath?
Yeah, we'll be like, she meant blah, 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 or whatever. Like, there's this kind of narrator function that we definitely use when we need to. And so I was like, that gets totally lost in audio, but it doesn't really matter. We don't use it so often that. So we'll do a writer's room on the night before we do Dumpster Fire.
Oh, you do? Okay.
It's not like a fancy writer's room. Simmer down. It's just like three of us going through. We do the board on Trello. I gather all the stories, whatever I bookmarked on Twitter, whatever I commented on Twitter. I have one person who does research and catches stories, and then anything we were texting each other in our group chat. Then we decide the order of the board. We put it in all our little categories on the Trello board. We rearrange it. Then we go through and write any kind of jokes. We just riff. And then I just have my paper with the jokes we came up with. And then dumpster fire, really, we always joke like dumpster fire happens to us. Because we'll have this joke and all this stuff, but then something will take, you know, we all come in a mood. We're shooting in my undisclosed location. So there's no AC. It's there's dogs. 2 weeks ago, there was like
there's
a helicopter. Outside.
There's a big lemon tree.
2 weeks ago, there was a helicopter flying around, so we had to take a break. So it's very rugged and raw. So yeah, it feels totally different than this medium, which feels more like let's sit down and have lemonade and just talk like you would have a conversation with your friend. A lot of the time, I use it to catch up with my friends.
So you agree that it's different media that you're talking about. Like your previous thing is visual, and though you would think it'd be more impromptu, it's actually super engineered and scripted, but this is more unscripted. It's just cool. Okay.
Yeah. They're weird like that.
Yeah, because a lot of people think Club is like, oh, it's just podcasts. Like, no. like most podcasts are not as kind of unscripted as they seem. Well, like, you know, you're saying so. Interesting.
Well, I think I learned, I think too, I just really... because I love Rogan's style of, it's just more me to just sit down and have a conversation and see how it goes and just shoot the shit. And some things will come up and some things won't. Some people will come on for one specific thing, and that is cool. You know, someone's like, I like how you're having these more pointed discussions about topics, but that's off. Like, publishers reach out to me all the time because my audience buys books. And now they know, so they'll be like, hey, and if I'm interested in the book, I'm like, hell yeah, have them come through. And it's a good reason for me to read books. And so
we
in
have
that,
a very nice bookshelf behind me.
Thank
with,
you.
Recent volumes, a lot of stuff, good stuff, actually.
So I'll have, those are all the people whose like podcast book is down there I need to read. And it's definitely, so there's that aspect of it. And then there's just having my friends, and I have so many friends who are comedians. I love those conversations. They're just very rambling and fun. So I think it's every guest is different on here. You know, I want the guest to really inform the show more than me trying to like have some agenda and drive what it's like, what it feels like.
Yeah, the Rogan thing is interesting because these podcasts are like 3.5 hours long.
And people love them.
And they love them. It's funny. And you know, I don't actually, I'm starting to do a bunch of podcasts. I'm actually talking to, nothing's firm yet, but it's probably going to happen. Matt TV maybe, or an us do a podcast or something.
Together?
And potentially, yeah.
He's coming on Monday.
Oh, is he? Yeah. Okay, cool. Interesting. Yeah, so, and it's funny because I actually don't listen to that many podcasts. I'm really much more of a visual and textual person. I only listen to podcasts with when I'm driving. But I agree, they have a unique reach, and they have a feeling that you know the person.
It's funny, I don't listen to as many as I should, just because when I do have free time, all I want to do is listen to music. So all my audio time is devoted to my insane addiction to music. And I definitely love the medium in terms of... That's what's so wild. So we have this generation that's like, no attention span, and yet my nephew, who's 17, he loves Rogan. And like, these are the kids who have no attention span, but they're also the kids who will listen to 3 hours of Rogan. So there's a weird disconnect in terms of attention span, and that's like the thing that I've been trying to get my mind around is is there an actual attention span deficit, or is it?
Do they do it 100%? Because he just sit there for 3 hours and doesn't do anything, do something else.
I think most people are doing something else and they're listening to podcasts. That's it. I think almost everyone I know listens to podcasts when they're cooking or cleaning or driving or working out, or they're not just like sitting focusing on the podcast.
I know. I used to listen to podcasts when I would split wood when I was up in the Northwest. And I know it sounds ridiculously Little House on the Prairie, but if you're heating your house with a wood stove and there's like nothing else, you got to split wood a lot.
Yeah.
And so I would probably, and then also if you had woods to maintain, you'd like down trees and buck them and split them. And it's just part of, I didn't realize when you bought woods that you became like lumberjack. So I became a lumberjack. And I would just, yeah, I would listen. I would listen to Car Switcher's podcast a lot back in the day. And, yeah, like an hour of splitting wood and listening to various podcasts. And now I almost need to do that.
Yeah. I think it's background for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's background. Totally.
But I have a really hard time focusing. I think it also depends on what kind of learner you are. Right. Like books on tape. I do the same thing with movies. I can't really miss something that someone says. I will have to like rewind it. I don't want to fill in the blank.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And when I'm listening to a book on tape, for instance, and walking my dog, if my dog like jerks at a dog, and then now I have to rewind it, and I can just read much faster than it takes me to actually listen to a book on tape.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens with podcasts where people will listen to it in the background and they'll get bits and pieces and they're fine with that. And I can't do that.
Yeah.
I need to listen to like every word.
Yeah, I'm the guy who, if you showed up like 4 minutes late to the movie, I'm just like, I can't watch.
Yeah.
I missed these critical 4 minutes. Who knows? I don't know what's going on anymore.
This should be a study because I think it is a personality type. Because my husband's like he'll say something to me when we're watching something and then I'm like, now he has to rewind it. And he's like, you can kind of guess what they said.
Yeah.
This is the other weird thing too, the rise of everybody watches shows and everything now, not just because I think they're all going deaf and sound, but they have the subtitles on almost all the time. It feels like everybody does this. It feels like more. I feel like I read something recently about how this is like a new I don't know if it's
interesting. You know, I'm going.
I'm just so fascinated with media in general. I can talk about this stuff all. I think so much about it.
So am I. It's nuts that we're living in the world of the spectacle. Yeah, the subtitle thing is interesting. I'm a total Israeli TV bender because I'm traveling to Israel, and as you can tell, I'm involved in this weird Jewish conversion process going on. I'm wearing a little kippah for those who aren't watching. I guess there's no camera, but it is interesting that the subtitle thing. I'm quite proud about that. If you think people are just watching with subtitles all the time.
Yeah, and they have the volume on, but a lot of the times I'll miss something that they said, but I'll catch it because of the subtitles. So I won't miss it, and then I won't have to rewind it because I won't be like, what did they say? Or I also wonder too if it's because people are also kind of scrolling while they're watching.
That's what I think. That's exactly. I think it's interesting. It's a melding of the textual and the oral media in a way that people are just doing both at once in a way, right? Or people like you and me are, right? Because we spend our entire day staring at a screen. Staring at pixels. Isn't that just crazy?
I don't spend that much time staring at... I've been way better. I go, and maybe it's just a phase, but I've been so... There was a really great thing on Twitter that I saw yesterday, and I retweeted it. And it was a woman who said, pretty crazy that none of this would have happened without Twitter. And it was a picture of her responding... Someone responding to something that she tweeted, and then... her DMing him and saying like, I'm just going to be honest, I would totally marry you. And he was like, that would be cool. Then they got married and the final picture was her having their baby.
Jesus Christ.
So there was her like four, you know, picture story of how they met on Twitter, basically.
That child's existence is due to a tweet.
Yeah. A tweet about like who keeps goats in their house or something. It was some weird tweet about goats. And my friend was like, this is why I stay here, because I would be really cynical and this place can be very beautiful. And it has connected me to so many people that are friends in my life and have become friends in real life and are good friends. And I try not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it does feel like maybe it just feels like the Overton window is closing me and that there's just not, I don't feel like there's a space for me in Twitter. Because it's so binary. I just feel like if I'm not in either one, I'm tired of being like piled on by all sides. It's exhausting.
Piled on a lot?
I don't really see it that often, but I don't know that there's a space. Like maybe that's not the best medium for me anymore. Even though I love it. I think it's fun when it's fun, but.
What would be better, more visual or audio medium?
But maybe just, I mean, I don't know.
Or just different people. Is the mechanism fine? It's just the people on it that you
know? No, I don't know that it's, something changed about it. Something changed about the algorithm or something. I don't see anyone's tweets anymore that I follow. It definitely feels.
Maybe you should block more. Because I block like crazy now. Like I wrote a post about like the virtue of blocking. Create a block wall and just forget about whole parts of the world. And I'd say, even with this whole Apple thing, I really didn't see that much negativity, like, specifically. Like, if I searched for my name and, like, went to other threads, maybe. But me specifically, not really.
It's not the negativity, even. It's more what I feel like it's encouraging in the conversation. It just seems like, you said, it's bringing out the worst in people and in the conversation. And I don't know. I don't really know how to. There's no part of me being on Twitter that's going to make that better. It's incentivized to bring out the worst in us. Even when they're like, we're going to fix this. And now you can't, you can only reply to some people. And I'm like, so you just encourage everyone dunking on everyone with quote tweets. Like, it seems crazy to me.
Well, Bridget, maybe it's not Twitter that's going insane. Maybe the whole world has just gone crazy and we need to create a different nation state or a different decentralized entity.
Feels very strange, like strange times to me in general.
How do you think this ends, Bridget? 30 years from now, what's going to look like? Is it going to be more of the same? Is there going to be an actual secession, like a cold civil war, or some other crisis going
to
happen?
I feel like that's what's been upsetting to me, is that it seems as if there's a virtual civil war going on, and it just hasn't spilled out into the streets in a major way. We see little pockets of it, like scuffles in cities like Portland, and you'll see these extreme ends of this conversation getting in fights, and I think most people want out of it, but it does seem as that, I mean, Jonah Goldberg always says it, like, this is your brain on tribalism. It's just, or maybe he doesn't say that. He says something like, don't do tribalism. But I have been just looking at how, like you said, nothing rises to the level of getting any attention if it's not processed through the tribal brain.
Right.
And so, it's increasingly harder for me to even have conversations with anyone who's in that tribal process, because it's not even worth it.
But we've always had a tribal brain, right? Like, in some sense,
of course,
the past 40, 50 years of media have been the exception, not the rule.
Right. But I think that's what Jonah says in his book about
the suicide of the left.
Yeah. He talks about how we stumbled into this miracle and we somehow, like, overcame our very, very basic instincts. And then now it seems to be taking over again.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've often thought that. I read a lot in Wired about how, like, this, the new media, the new journalism, which is, like, let's face it,
journalism.
Right, which is pamphleteering, and I don't mean that necessarily in a negative way. I mean, Ben Franklin was a pamphleteer. Sam Adams, who was actually a newspaper publisher in addition to being a brewer, was also a pamphleteer. But that, you know, that's the model of journalism as we've typically seen it. So in some sense, we're just going back to the 19th century standard. That's anyone who knows their history, you realize the 19th century wasn't exactly a polite time to live. It was kind of a very hard time to live, where you had a sitting vice president, Aaron Burr, shoot a former secretary of the treasury in New Jersey and get away with it. It's just like over things that have been published. You know, there were all anon shit posters that had been published. I think it was Madison who had alleged that Burr's wife had been unfaithful or something.
Right.
Via one of his, you know, a troll, an anon account, basically. They killed each other. And so, you know, we're returning to that world. But the other side of me, this is the Bruno Machais theory. You know, his theory is that this is all LARP, right? This is all basically fantasy. Americans are actually, you know, just basically sublimating their hate for each other. There's going to be no Fort Sumter shots fired in the Civil War. It's never going to happen. It's all going to happen on Twitter, and that's the end of it. You know, again, you know, is Twitter real life or not? I think that's the real question.
Well, that's my joke I always make, is America's too fat for a civil war.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody can actually run a mile and shoot a rifle.
We're actually super comfortable, too. So as much as everybody loves, like, and that's a weird thing of, like, outsourcing this outrage, and I do agree a lot of it is just LARPing, and maybe it's just blowing off steam.
Yeah.
Maybe if people didn't have this outlet on Twitter, they'd be, like, actually more fighting in the streets. But
yeah.
I don't know that anybody would really know that much about any of this either.
Right. I mean, it's surprising how relatively little has spilled into the street, given how heated it seems to feel, right? Like, sure, you've got the Proud Boys, all 15 of them. You know, that said, when Twitter, like, look at, I'm always, you know, Francis Suarez, the mayor of Miami, basically tweeted Miami onto the tech map. I don't know how much you've seen of this, but a lot of tech people have moved there, and it's kind of a thing. Like, it's not the new San Francisco or anything, but it's definitely another stop on the sort of train for tech, in a way that it wasn't before. And he just tweeted into existence. At some point, Twitter does become reality.
No, I say this all the time. I'm like, Twitter, it's not representative, but it's influential.
Right.
And it is like a little think tank where everybody's writing literally think pieces, and they're in there duking it out. And I'll say something. My example I always use is, for instance, you'll see like a gay character in a Marvel movie, the average person will be like, oh, that's weird. Anyway, they won't know that that appeared because the director got called out for not representing, right. And there was a whole thing on Twitter, and then someone got canceled, and now that it's like, it still influences the culture at large.
Yeah, it almost reminds me, there was this, there's this notion in like European intellectual history, what was called the Republic of Letters, which was sort of, a historian would probably date this better than I would, from, you know, call it the end of the Middle Ages, like Renaissance, up until modernity, from like the 15th to the 18th century, that was people like, you know, Kant having a conversation with, I forget who, either PSP or maybe Descartes or something. And it, you know, and it was obviously like a high level elite conversation. It wasn't necessarily held in newspapers, although occasionally they would write publicly. But it was the, sort of this backdrop to the intellectual culture of the time. And I'm sure downstream of it, things like the French Revolution would happen,
right.
That in some sense were the output of, you know, John Locke having a conversation with whoever else, Hume or whoever. I'm probably muddling who actually were the nodes in the graph talking to each other. But you would have this, you know, Twitter is kind of the Republic of Letters, that things happen, elites talk to each other, weird shit spins off from that and has impact on the culture, and people downstream of that maybe didn't even know the initial tweet that started it.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It just becomes part of, I mean, I think we saw that with things like CRT.
Right.
You know, where it that's like everything gets flattened. So people were having this conversation about cancel culture, and then the minute I see it on Fox, I'm like, oh, shit. It's gone mainstream. You know, it's hit the mainstream.
Yeah, so it
obviously... Hit the boomers.
Right.
When the boomers start repeating stuff, I'm like, oh, shit.
Right, so it starts in Twitter. It goes to Substack. It'll hit Vox and BuzzFeed. Reddit for sure.
Reddit's
New York
really
Times
early.
And New York Magazine. And then Fox will have, like, the reaction to it. And then that's the full epistemological chain. And then you end up, and then it's on to the next one, like, 3 weeks later.
This is that freaking book that I talk about. Every single person I have who comes on and talks about media, Mediated.
Oh, it's a great book. I love that. Yeah.
No one else has read it.
I know. It's funny.
You're
the
only person I talked to. I mentioned this book. I'm interviewing him.
Oh, really?
Finally.
Oh, cool.
But that guy called it 2006.
Yes.
When that book came out, I was like, I have to get this. And I read it. And I did not fully understand postmodernism even then, because I didn't go to college. I didn't know what it was. I understood a lot of what he was talking about in terms of the self-representational and reflexive nature of media. And
right.
This was like pre-social media that...
Yeah.
I've been begging him to write another follow-up book to this.
Yeah, so in case people don't know who that is, because it's funny, I name-dropped his book in Marshall Kosloff's The Realignment podcast this week as well, and it's Thomas
DeZenko, yeah.
It's really hard to pronounce
Zenkotita.
Zenkotita. It's called Mediated, and it's kind of overlooked. I mean, you can still find it. I mean, it's still in print, or at least you can buy the used versions of it, but he totally called much of what we're talking
all
about.
All of it.
It's
There's
hard.
A fucking chapter called Identity Politics
right.
in his book.
Yeah. And the key thing... One of the scenes in the book that I find, well, there's two scenes in the book that I find most striking. He opens it. The opening with the JFK assassination thing, which there's a lot of setup there. I don't know if this actually could translate in a podcast setup, but so I guess he was in like an Strasbourg style method acting class in which, for those who aren't familiar with this school of acting, you know,
it's method acting.
It's method acting. You're supposed to actually experience the emotions rather than this sort of Shakespearean distance or whatever. And so like, If there's an exercise where like, oh, you find out your mother just died and you're supposed to feel the feelings of pathos or whatever. So anyhow, it's like whatever it is, November 22nd, 1963, and someone walks into the door and says, JFK has been shot.
This story is horrifying.
I know. And then everyone starts acting as if the president had gotten shot.
They're thinking, like, oh, this is the drill.
This is the drill.
Yeah.
Like, we're here for this. Like, it happened to be time, like, right when the class started. Everyone emotes for 20 minutes, and then someone walks in and says, like, No. In reality, like, the president actually got shit. Like, that's what's happening right here. Here's a TV. And then, like, literally, he said he ran out the room. He just couldn't handle it. He never went back to acting. He never went back to the class. Just over. Like, how can you have... And the key reason why he raised that is, like, there's this question in society, and again, like, Gen Z is, like, not even understand what we're talking about, but it used to be among boomers, like, where were you when you learned that JFK was shot? Like, when did you have the collective media phenomenon of this... phenomenon at a distance that didn't directly impact you. You weren't there, but you had a collective feeling of it happening to you. And if you contrast that to like the greatest generation, like where were you when you heard about Pearl Harbor? Wasn't a question anybody asked because there was no image to share. It wasn't a collective media phenomenon.
Right.
Like you maybe read about it. Certainly it impacted your life, but you didn't feel as if it had happened in a real direct way. And it was that point in which the culture switched and, you know, distant phenomenon that really aren't related to you suddenly became figures in your life in the same way that Twitter, like, will make your heart rate shoot up. And you've mediated life. Reality, what you experience has now been catered to you. The other story that he has in that I really remember is that he mentions, like, his car breaking down in Saskatchewan, Canada or something, middle of nowhere, and the car just breaks down, and you're stuck. And nothing's mediated. Like, you know, you've got, like, a tumbleweed going by. There's, like, a burden. You realize your entire setting is no longer engineered to please and interface with you. It's just, like, and there's this feeling of just enemy and disconnect. It's like, oh, my God, what is going on? And so, anyhow, it's a great book.
It's so, I read it every year. And it's, this is so exciting for me to nerd out about this book. The other thing that really stuck out for me is the Princess Di anecdote, where he talks about, this was right after kind of the dawn of that switch and the 24-hour news cycle, and how everyone knew their role. Everybody knew, like, what role they were supposed to play in this global, you know, expression of grief, and the mourners with their flowers. Right. And it, I think about this book every day. Every day. Just the whole, how he breaks down, you know, real. There's real.
I need to reread it.
It's so good. I think it's right behind you.
Oh, is it? Let's see.
It's right behind you.
I'm sitting in front of
It's next to the Joseph Campbell one.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, it's like destroyed. That one and Trickster Makes This World, I read them pretty much every year. But yeah, he just absolutely nailed it. Just nailed it.
Fascinating. Yeah, and he's like a PhD in anthropology. It's interesting, isn't it?
He's just so... I remember reading that book on a beach and being like, oh my God, I'm reading the future.
Yeah, it's a mind-blowing book.
And he's such a great writer.
Yeah.
It's actually entertaining in the way he... And the other one that I always think about is Justin's Helmet Principle. The whole idea of, if your kid can be safer, why wouldn't you make your kid safer? You know, we didn't... Like, he was talking about how they didn't have to wear helmets, but then they found out that all these kids are getting brain... And you don't want to be the parent that doesn't make your kid wear a helmet, because... That would be horrible if something happened to your kid. But then now, kind of fast-forwarding into the coddling of the American mind, it's fascinating.
Yeah, this triumph of safetyism is another thing that I can't quite remember. I did a post about, like, in my Miami childhood, which I use as a reference point of A, pre-internet era, and B, living inside a weird little ethnic tribe, which, you know, is considerably at variance with the modern discourse around white privilege and all this stuff. And so I was just, one of the footnotes was like, you remember this, right? Like, the amount of stuff, shit that you could get away with in the pre-smartphone era as a kid, or as just, like, anybody. Like, the shit that we would do and just, like, think, well, like, if no one literally dies or goes to the hospital, nobody gets arrested, then, like, whatever, it didn't happen. Who cares? It just doesn't matter. Like, whatever, right? There used to be this thing in Miami. People don't really do it anymore. Who knows? Maybe they do. But they used to fire guns in the air, like, you know, Afghan tribesmen or something. On New Year's, 12 shots in the air. You know, obviously barbarous custom. Kind of fun. And, you know, I remember doing this as a kid, like holding up a Glock and firing 12 rounds in the air and then drinking soda with my parents and eating 12 grapes. I'm just like, oh, well, whatever. So it's cool. Like, now, like, nobody could get away with doing that.
No.
Or, like, drag racing in high school or dating or getting drugs. All this random shit that would just never follow you. It's like, a moment happened, you had a formative experience around it, and that's it. It's gone. There's just, your average person didn't, you know, wasn't a celebrity that lived kind of in the eye of the camera all the time. I think everyone's internalized, in some sense, being a celebrity. And it's like, I think I said this in Cast Monkeys, right? Like, the famous Andy Warhol quote, like, in the future, everyone's going to be famous for 15 minutes. That's totally wrong. Everyone's going to be famous 24/7 to 15 people, right? That's really what it is. And so to live your life like a celebrity without the countervailing things like wealth or whatever is strange. And
well, it's just, that's mediated.
Yeah.
Is like, who are we on the... That's why that book was so mind-blowing to me. I was like, this is the first guy who's taken a step back and said, whoa, whoa, whoa. How is this affecting us? Like, how we started this conversation. How is this affecting us just on a fundamental level as human beings? Yeah. It's obviously rewiring our brains.
Yeah, and people like you, I don't know if you saw Caitlin Flanagan had a piece about, like, her quitting Twitter. She quit Twitter for
20 days. I've done this before with Twitter.
Yeah, and it's. I mean, she's correct in that it totally, if you're living life in the spotlight, like, you try to recycle everything in your daily life for the spectacle. Again, you feel that mediated feeling. And it's interesting. Yeah, it's a strange way to look.
I had this moment last night. My cousin's read this book, and she's a producer on this, too. She does the editing. And we were doing this, like, I started making jokes, and we were just in the moment, and it was really funny. And then she's like, oh, we should record you.
See?
doing this for content. And I'm like, it's mediated. It just, you can't, you can't help it. I mean, that's also being a comedian. So
yes.
There's, I'm doubly, like, comedianism is a thing, too, I think, that should have a 12-step program.
No, I agree, because that used to piss me off about comedians, because they always try to be funny. You know when you're in the presence of a comedian, because they're always trying to, like, get the spotlight and tell the joke. And if they're funny, obviously, it's great, but if not, it's not.
Or good. It's always looking for, so I had to, oh, to open up about my moment of shame. So we'll circle back completely, and then we can wrap it up. I had this moment yesterday. I was like wondering what it was all for because of this existential crisis we just spent an hour talking about. And like, what am I doing? None of this is real. Do I even matter? Why do I think I matter? I hate all of this. I hate everyone. I hate myself.
Jesus, Bridget. Okay.
I have those moments. I'm also an alcoholic, so it's just like goes with the territory. But I was having this kind of moment.
Okay.
I generally only have them in really bad traffic, but I was having this existential...
You have like a falling down moment, like
Every time. I was in traffic the other night going to Glendale for something, and it was the first time I'd been in traffic in a while in LA. And
you were on the 10, at rush hour.
What the fuck am I... Well, 405.
The 405.
What the fuck am I doing with my life? And I'm like, God, this is so sad. And so I was on Dubline for my column, and I'm like, what am I even fucking writing about? And who cares about any of it? And my column is about, can you be liberal and love America? That's like that was the topic I was thinking about. And then I was thinking about how the New York Times wrote that piece. They had that thing that went viral on Twitter. They tweeted about how some think opinion piece they posted that was about like the American flag brings up a lot and it can be divisive or whatever.
Right. The American flag.
The American flag is divisive. And so I ended up on Fox, and then there was a video because I was looking for something where I couldn't, I'm not going to pay for the New York Times. So I'm like, who's going to give some synopsis of this? And then I start watching this video, and it's a V-Shred ad. This fucking douchebag who, this is my moment of shame.
Uh-oh, okay.
It's a video where he's talking, he's like, are you a woman who's just been battling with, like, going on diets and you're not happy with your body? And I swear to God, I watched a whole 30-minute, basically, infomercial from this fucking douchebag and then bought the V-Shred.
What is the V-Shred?
It's like a freaking, it's an app and it's like a diet plan and just, it's fucking stupid.
That was your moment of shame.
Oh, God. I'm still and now, so then, you get, I was talking to my therapist about this and she's like, I swear to God, Bridget, you're my funniest client. Because I'm like, now I'm in this hateful shame loop that I can't get out of because they kept sending me emails after I signed up, which I already felt ashamed about. And they're like, hey, have you tried the supplements? You got to try the supplements, supplements, supplements. And so I email back to one of their emails. They're like, I'm like, if you send me one more cell about supplements, I'm going to cancel this plan before I even start it. And then it's an auto-generated email that comes back and it's a coupon for supplements. I was like, what?
Your life is the supplements from now on. It's just supplements all the way down.
I seriously was like, I'm going to kill myself. I was just like, this is rock bottom. V-Shred is rock
bottom. V-Shred is rock
bottom. What rock bottom is V-Shred? And it's just like this, you do daily workouts. It was like 90 days to shred. I would never, I don't know what was going on with me, but... And it was like a 30-minute video. I don't have attention span for this shit. I can't even handle it. I don't know what this... Was this an AI generated in a lab to, like, speak directly to every...
You bought it. You bought the food blender. You bought the...
I bought it.
Yeah.
It's so embarrassing. I mean... And then, of course, I was talking to my therapist about it, trying to explain what happened, and she's laughing, and I'm like, I should turn this into a stand-up routine. It's, like, mediated.
Yes.
Being a comedian, you're already mediating everything.
Right.
That's what I mean about it's doubly bad when you're a comedian. Because now, as a comedian, you're walking through the world and everything was... There was always this narrator in my brain before I even knew I was a comedian that was, like, making fun of everything.
It was there to begin with. Okay.
There to begin with. My mom sent me to this stupid thing. It was, like, healing your aloneness workshop. I have these moments where it's just like the writer, maybe it's just a function of being a writer, where there's someone who's narrating. I'm like, this is the dumbest shit. And we were holding hands at the end and I couldn't stop laughing. I was laughing so hard. I had tears rolling down my cheeks, and then they thought I was crying because I was moved, and then they realized I was laughing, and they like threw my hand away, and they were so mad. It was so, my aloneness was not healed that day.
But I think it's a common thing. Like, I have lived life in this weird writerly dissociation in which, like, if I were to write this in an essay, like, any given moment, like, literally any, even the most mundane thing, like, standing in line winning the Trader Joe's and just some, like, weird guy with, like, a bizarre Hawaiian shirt who has nothing but, like, you know, Easter Bunny chocolates
and
six crates of, like, you know, two-buck chuck or whatever it is, or something, just some bizarre, like, who the hell is this guy? What's going on? Like, there's always that voice in my head. Always.
Yeah. I do think it's a function of being a writer. So that's what got me thinking when I was reading that book. I'm like, well, writers are already subject to this. Like, right. As a writer, you're already mediating your whole
right.
life.
That's right.
And then now it's like on fire. For me, it's like throwing gasoline on fire. Right. And sometimes I just think, I seriously can't believe it. I can't believe I even admitted it publicly, but I should probably let it go. My V-tread. So embarrassing. If you saw this guy, you would fucking
And now you've
cry.
Plugged it. It's incredible.
No,
you totally plugged it.
I didn't mean to.
Maybe you pay for podcast ads. Well, you
oh, my God. Look at this fucking douchebag. Hold on.
Shred. Oh, I like the logo. Look at that.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Look. Six-pack shred.
Oh, look. My You're custom diet plan is days. Here. You're gonna toned in 90 days.
Wow. And it's just exercise.
And then you just put on day one, and this is the fucking dude.
Wow. What's going on? Welcome to your Monday workout.
I mean, it's tailored. He knows I'm a lady.
Body and abs is going to be wow. about an 18-minute workout.
He looks pretty shredded.
We got a bunch of exercises.
This fucking dude. I watched a half an hour. It was like 45 minutes. This is also the function of procrastination.
Right.
And
you were on your deadline. You were on deadline. Exactly.
I'm at my weakest. You could sell me anything on deadline.
The algorithm's probably figured out. If your deadline's on Friday, they know to hit you with it on Thursday or Friday.
Some girl, I was like on Twitter yesterday, and I've opened up my DMs for some reason, and then I just left them open. I'm like, whatever. And this girl was like, hey, I need your advice. And I was like, perfect. I've got all the time in the world. What do you need? Like, you caught me at a good time. She's like, oh, cool. I'm like, I'm on deadline. This is when I will organize my spices alphabetically. No, the other thing I did was I decided that it was the perfect time to figure out where my gas main was in case of an earthquake so that I could turn it off. Ah. And I spent an hour finding the right tool.
Did you find it?
Well, we ordered one and it didn't work, and so then I had to find another tool. But now, yeah, I think I've got it dialed in. I'm keeping the tool in case my neighbors need help. Psycho. I'm a psycho. Anyway, this has been really fun.
Thank you, Bridget. Yes, it has been fun.
I hope everyone... Okay, so where can we find you? And your Substack. Plug all your stuff.
Sure, Twitter,
You're like,
at...
gonna be on V-Shred.
Exactly, V-Shred. I'm gonna shred it abs in 90 days. Or bust. On Twitter at AntonioGM or thepullrequest.com is the Substack. And that's what I'm doing now. And I write about sometimes more geeky stuff like ads and privacy and data, which I've been doing for various companies for 10 to 15 years. Most recently at Apple, before that at Facebook and other companies.
The algorithm is so smart.
Sort of. It's not as smart as people say, but sure.
It knows me. Go follow his Substack, everyone. Oh, shoot. I have to ask you my two questions I ask everyone.
Oh, okay. Oh, dear.
What is your biggest defect of character or vice? You can interpret that.
God, I have so many. I have to pick my favorite. It's like, if you ask me what my virtues, there's a smaller number to choose amongst.
That's the next question.
Is it?
I like to end on a high note.
And, of course, what... people in my life would answer it. It may not be what I would answer to this question. Certainly my exes would probably answer different questions. What is my biggest vice? Of the traditional, like, Christian vices? Like,
no, so, it can be, like, or defect of characters. A lot of people are like, oh, that's, like, therapy or 12. So you can honestly interpret it. It can be what you're trying to better yourself today. It can be something that plagues you your whole life.
Yeah, I think, Well, let me just be Christian about it and frame it in terms of the Christian vices. At least it frames it a little bit. One of those would be gluttony. Not that I eat that much, although certainly I could probably
Do I have a program?
Yeah, exactly. Let's be sure. But it's gluttony as regards to everything. Like, everything I do, I tend to do completely over the top in an excessive way that's just completely life-wrecking. And I think I'm just slowing down because I'm getting older, and, like, you just can't be on that train for much longer. But even now, I'm still kind of on it. And so I think that over-excessive investment in everything. And then, you know, anger a little bit, but not, that's a little bit less than it used to be. And then is the next one virtues?
Yeah.
Your
biggest asset.
It shouldn't be this hard for me to think of one. Well, I mean, it's a flip side of the same thing. This sounds like a ridiculous job interview question. It's like, oh, what's your biggest?
I just
work too hard.
I just care too much.
I take my job too seriously. But yeah, the obsession. When I think back, like, you know, I don't think I'm really smart. I certainly didn't come from a privileged or name brand background. What's the only thing that set me apart, or even landed me spots at these companies or these places? It was really the obsessive focus and the willingness to stop at nothing to get there, which I think was life wrecking in other regards, and I actually regret it in many ways. And I think. I could have gotten there without the same level of, like, personal destruction along the way. But that, you know, without any doubt, that was definitely part of it.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, yeah. Thank you for coming by.
Yeah, thank you
this was really fun.
Always
and
fun chatting.
I love that. Yeah, you can come by anytime.
Sure.
And now I finally met someone who's also read Mediated, and my whole day is made.
It's time for the weekly check-in with Bridget and Cousin Maggie. Well, let's talk about other people being stupid for once, Maggie, instead of us. It's just so ugly. The whole culture war thing is so stupid. I hate it so much. Both parties are dead to me. Dead to me now. I'm just so over, like, the vaccine thing makes me want to, like, claw my fucking eyes out.
Yeah.
Just the fighting about it and the way people talk about it and the way people talk to people who are hesitant about it. Like, oh, you fucking idiots. Like,
yeah.
I don't blame people for not wanting to get it. I don't blame them.
It is like testing.
Yeah. We're fucking guinea pigs.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get my period for 3 months. That could be because maybe I have menopause, but now I'm finding out that maybe that's not true and I have to get tested. My levels have to get tested again.
Wow.
Because now I'm just back on a cycle.
Weird.
My sister... She's late after the vaccine. Like, we don't know. We don't freaking know.
Yeah.
And because they didn't even think to study how COVID affected women, because women are still a second class citizen in the world, they have no idea how the vaccine affects them.
Yeah.
It's so annoying. Patriarchy is truly very crafty. So, yeah, I don't blame people. And then when you start banning people for even talking about it, and even having questions and even having discussions about it. And then you start, like, it's not making any of this better.
No, that's the terrifying part, is, like, you're not allowed to have debate and question and, like, be like, well, I have hesitations because of these things, whatever.
I mean, I think there's a big difference between people who think that it's going to, like, put a microchip in them and have 5G bats attracted to them.
Yes.
And people who have legitimate concerns about what the side effects are, because we really have no way of knowing.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like there are shades of, you know, there are shades of hesitancy.
Yes.
And then there's just, like, plain old, you know, old fashioned anti-vaxxers, which are also exist on both sides.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, you've got a whole shit show going on. And it's funny to me that people are like, well, back in the good old days, everyone just would have been on board. I'm like, well, I don't know that that's great.
Back in the good old days, there were no vaccines.
If you read the whole, like, history of the polio vaccine, there were like 56 kids that died in the first trial because of it was like the way they were storing it was bad. And mm-hmm. there wasn't really any checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And people were so desperate to get the vaccine because polio is polio,
right?
That they were, you know, they still lined up even after this happened,
right?
And it was like a lot of kids got polio from this batch because I forget what the whole thing was, but a lot of people also, like, 56 kids died or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine now? No. 56 kids died
it
from
would
this?
Be like the end of the world.
But polio is really freaking bad.
Yeah, polio is horrible. The dogs are going crazy.
That's what I hate about this virus, which is tragic and horrible and has killed a lot of people, and I don't want to minimize that. but it's not like your eyes are bleeding. It's not so bad that everyone can be united. It's like just bad enough.
Right, right, that it's divisive.
Yeah.
The mortality rate isn't like gigantic.
It's not like the 9/11 of viruses.
It's not like smallpox or polio or, you know, like the really, truly terrible.
It can't like unite the country for a moment.
No, it can't. It can't.
It's just dividing us even more. It's almost like it was created in a lab.
Specifically for this purpose. Oh, boy. Here we go.
I have so much stand-up in me today.
That's the bandwagon Bridget's jumping on.
Yes. This was
It's all a conspiracy.
Shit.
It was created as a form of control.
Team Mitch McConnell was frickin' going off the rails today about how if everybody doesn't get vaccinated, we're going to go back into lockdowns. It's like the government threatening to ground you. It's so stupid. They're like, if you don't eat your peas, we're going to lock you in your room. Take away all of your fun times. You won't be able to see your friends. No one's having it.
No. I don't know what's going on.
Nothing is going on. It is literally psyops. That's what's going on. It feels like we are in a giant psychological like matrix.
It is definitely, even still in California, going places since they put the mask mandate back in place. A lot of people still aren't wearing masks indoors. And I'm kind of like, yep, everyone's just kind of like, no, fuck it.
Yeah, they're over it. Or they can't remember or whatever. It's just so confusing. And that's not, again, to minimize the fact that hospitalizations are going up. Mm-hmm. The virus is very real. Mm-hmm. There's that great expression. There's that expression I read in an article about the Indian death toll, which is apparently like 3 million, like so
horrible.
Much worse than they're reporting, which does not surprise me. There's a 1.3 billion people in India, so that's nothing. Mm-hmm. And I was reading about how they were like, you can't, like coffins don't lie, funeral pyres don't lie. You can't, like you can believe whatever you want to believe, but like
the number of
cadavers dead. Don't lie.
Well, I was reading an article about the COVID widows in India and how like, you know, actually they were like, we don't have exact numbers, especially from certain regions, about how many men versus women died, but it seems like more men died and they were the main breadwinners of their family and a lot of their wives, like they're leaving them with kids to support, no means of like, it's some, a lot of the women are uneducated and can't read. And so there's really this, they're facing this kind of terrifying future of what do we do now?
Yeah.
And they have no income all of a sudden.
I read an article about how like a million kids have been orphaned or lost one, at least one parent to COVID. And I think that's in the world, which actually doesn't seem like that many, but still a lot.
Yeah.
And then there's like all these stories we didn't cover happening around us.
I know.
And the fucking fires and floods.
The fires, the floods, the just the droughts, the
We're living in the apocalypse.
It's
we're
slow
actually
building.
In the apocalypse.
Yeah, it's a slow burn, but it started.
It has begun. And it's the 20th anniversary of 9/11 coming up.
Wow.
Which I can't stop thinking about for some reason because I can't believe it was 20 years ago.
No, neither can I. It's crazy.
I'm going to be in New York.
Of course you are. You're like, if the shit's going down, I'm going to go see it.
If the shit's going down. No, it just feels like weird that it's been 20 years.
Definitely.
Can't believe it. I remember sitting in that little frickin' shoebox like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. My nephew going down the slide for the first time as the towers came down. I'll never forget it. Mm-hmm. And then just like not being able to get off the couch.
Well, the weird thing is too, I feel like when the first plane, after the first plane hit, you and your sister pulled out your
video recorder.
And we're like, we're recording this. And then, so you caught your reaction to the second plane hit.
Talk about mediated.
Yeah.
We were already videotaping because my nephew just was going down the slide for the first time. So we were already videotaping everything, but then this was like an actual moment where he did something for the first time.
So
we already had it out and we were rolling. And then it started unfolding and we just kept it going.
Yeah.
Like the shock, that like real life shock. I still am like, how did that happen?
I know.
Like, how did it happen? That was the first moment that I thought maybe we're living in a simulation, because it was so, like, just the way they came down, even.
I
it was
know.
Just so, it was like, you can't, I don't under, I still don't understand. And nothing's really ever, I mean, I had a client when I was teaching yoga, and he was like, your generation's been fucked ever since 9/11. He was like, 9/11 fucked every generation behind it.
No, it changed the world. It really did. It changed so many things.
Yeah. I mean, my nephews don't know not being at war. Mm. They've been at war since they were born. Mm-hmm. Or they haven't been. They've been at war, like, on video games.
Yeah.
They haven't been, like, getting
the
droned
country has
in
always
another
been
country.
Involved in a war.
Yeah. It's very strange times.
This has been a super uplifting check-in.
Hey, this is where we're at, Maggie.
I know. It is where we're
this
at.
This is what the check-in is.
This is the world today.
This is a no bullshit, unfiltered check-in. Two people just trying to make sense of it all.
Sometimes there is no making sense of it.
So I've been reading all these emails from people. I've been following up with my IamPoliticallyHomeless.com. Or my IamPoliticallyHomeless@gmail.com.
Uh-huh.
I had thousands of emails,
uh-huh,
from people telling me how they became politically homeless. Right to left, left to right, right to center, left to center, anarchist to, you know, like, radicalized right, whatever. All these people who are all over the place. And I've been following up with a lot of them and saying, how do you feel now? You know, post-election and post-pandemic. I was asking these questions before even the pandemic.
Right.
And every single response so far has been more hopeless.
Yeah.
That's not an uplift. That's probably why this check-in is kind of dark, because I was reading all those responses and I was like, oh, so everyone's actually doing worse.
Yeah, you need to be careful with your consumption of those emails.
Oh, again. I went back down the, so I went down the self-censorship email rabbit, uh-huh, hole the other night, because, uh-huh, Maggie basically made me stop reading them like 2 or 3 years ago.
Because she was, like, huddled in a corner in a dark room and hadn't come out for, like, 3 days and had these dark circles under her eyes. I was like, this is not good for you. Like, you need to stop. She's, like, in a corner of the room. It was bad.
On a mattress.
Yeah,
on
you
the
were,
floor.
Like, you looked like you were tweaking. It was, or, you know, some sort of,
I had, like, printed
den
them all out and was, like, putting them in different piles, Maggie.
It's like, okay, get out of this room.
And it was really, I think that's why I feel so frustrated with, like, a lot of the people who are now in the Substack space in particular, who are writing all these stories of, like, here's a story of self-censorship. I'm like, I fucking tried to tell you people all of these stories 4 years ago, not to mention pitch these stories, and you didn't want to even hear it, mm, or weren't even allowed to publish it.
But you were revisiting them.
Yeah, they're bad.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why I'm so bored with that. I'm like, yeah, no shit. We're headed towards communism, but who cares? Like, it's too late.
There just seems to be a slow cycle decline into chaos. Like, I just feel like we're disintegrating into chaos in so many different areas.
What people don't understand is that chaos was always, and this was a reprieve from that.
Yeah.
And we happen to fall in the reprieve,
like the,
and it's going to be much harder for us than it was for most of humanity,
mm-hmm,
because they were used to just getting raped and pillaged all the time
and knew how to, like, grow their own food and, you know,
be self-reliant,
hunt and gather and you know, make their,
like,
own shit.
Yeah. They weren't all out of shape because of the, you know, droughts and the plagues.
Oh man, we're so fucked.
And we're just going to be, we're even more screwed because we're soft.
We're soft. We're just a bunch of pussies.
What is that phrase that I love? Good times create soft people or something. There's some, like, kind of famous,
I don't know,
expression that's like, good times create soft people and hard times create hard people. I don't know.
Look it up, Bridget.
I feel like Google is my friend right now. So, yeah, that's why I spend a lot of time just preparing for the apocalypse, but it's stupid anyway.
It's also why we want to try, why we do try and focus on content that makes us laugh, that makes people laugh.
That's all I can do.
At
or
the very
think
least, that's all we can do.
Yeah. because of the, on the other hand, things have never been better. Uh-huh. We have vaccines.
Uh-huh.
We have antibiotics. Uh-huh. We have all kinds of things that we never had.
Running water and food.
And I try to stay focused on how we've actually never lived in the best time ever to be human. And that's still the case, even if it does feel like it might slip away in our lifetime.
We'll see how it goes.
Oh, God. I was at the beach talking to somebody about, like, what happens if there's a 7.0 earthquake here. And this person just is a lawyer and very nonchalantly described, like, what would happen, you know, in the first wave. And then in the second week, it would be, like, the roving gangs shooting people for water and shit. And
oh,
I was like,
God.
You know what's really unsettling is this is entirely possible. Buy guns and ammo. This is just going to be my refrain from now on.
That's the running theme now.
That should be one of our dumpster fire titles.
Yep.
And then we'll get banned. Tune in next week for another riveting episode that will change your life, help you get out of your own way, and solve all the world's problems. I want to thank our composer, Jared Elias, my co-producer and cousin, Maggie, and all of you out there listening. This has been Walk-Ins Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you're welcome. It's the dumbest line.